Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear how the local community is rallying around a local family, an integral part of the local food and farm community, after a tragedy befell them on Friday. Then we'll hear about a new community-curated exhibit that's opened at the Museum of Boulder. Rounding out today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear a new report that shows how children are still disproportionately impacted by environmental issues, and particularly now during the COVID-19 pandemic. After headlines from the BBC at the bottom of the hour, followed by a commentary from Jim Hightower, it's time for a public affair. And today, the Community Foundation of Boulder County takes a look at a new app from Pledge 1%, Colorado, and Equity Solutions. And it's intended to help businesses build competency in diversity, equity and inclusion. At 9 o'clock, it's media analysis from Counterspin, running out this morning's news on public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Demonstrations in Aurora on Saturday led to at least two people being injured as they protested the death of Elijah McLean at the hands of city officers and first responders nearly a year ago. The Sentinel reports that at about 7 p.m., a Jeep surged into herds of protesters walking in the northbound lanes of I-225, but it did not appear to hit anyone. One witness said a driver in the truck pulled quickly in front of the Jeep, ramming it and keeping it from plowing into people. After the Jeep ran into the crowd, one protester pulled out a gun and fired, appearing to be aiming at the Jeep. Instead, police said the shooter struck two people, one of whom suffered a graze wound, and another was taken to the hospital and was in stable condition. A short while later, about 150 people vandalized the Aurora courthouse. Police reported no arrests during the evening, and there were no physical confrontations between officers and protesters. Police are trying to identify the person who fired the gun, and they're discussing with prosecutors what charges to file against the driver of the Jeep, whom they have interviewed. Aurora Mayor Michael Kaufman issued a statement on Facebook on Sunday that said Aurora cannot become a Portland. He did not address the Jeep or the shooting, but focused on the vandalism, saying that he would be asking the interim chief of police why the courthouse was not adequately defended. A pro-police rally took place yesterday in Berthoud. It was met by counter-protesters, but according to 9 News, the situation remained peaceful, and hundreds of people gathered Saturday afternoon in Loveland for a Back the Blue demonstration to show support for local law enforcement. Also on Saturday, a man was arrested in Eaton after being accused of trying to drive over a crowd during a pro-police rally in the small Weld County community. A Boulder group that collected signatures during the pandemic for a November ballot issue is set to submit signatures to the city clerk's office today. The group No Eviction Without Representation is proposing a citizen initiative that would provide free legal counsel to all city renters who experience eviction. Rui Argano, with the group, says if approved by voters, the legal counsel would be free and available to anyone regardless of age, income, or immigration status. Argano believes the protection is long overdue because summonses to eviction court in Boulder increased by almost 30% from 2016 to 2019, a number expected to get worse due to job loss from COVID-19 that resulted in many not being able to pay their rent.
It's sort of a shame that a citizen initiative has to be the one to do this, as opposed to our elected officials implementing something like this. That being said, we are fortunate in a way that we can build on the shoulders of other tenant advocates and working class movements that have developed right to counsel programs and really improve on what has come before.
To fund the legal counsel, landlords who rent within the city limits would pay an annual $75 fee for each rental unit. Boulder City Council will consider a motion to accept the certification of sufficient valid signatures at its meeting tomorrow night. Governor Jared Polis said on Friday that he had struck a deal between the oil and gas industry and environmental groups to prevent ballot initiatives in the 2020 or 2022 elections. However, the Colorado Sun reports that any truce between those supporting oil and gas development and those in favor of more stringent regulations or moratoriums may be illusory. The governor said in an opinion piece published in Colorado Politics that there are no real winners in the fights, but that he was proud to report a path to make divisive oil and gas ballot fights a thing of the past. The purported agreement means that the industry-backed efforts to put two questions on this year's ballot will end. three other ballot initiatives related to oil and gas regarding setbacks, local moratoriums, and regulatory oversight also won't make the ballot, but the supporters behind those said the decisions reflect the difficulty of collecting the required number of signatures during a pandemic and not any deal with the governor. Ann Lee Foster, an environmental activist, said the governor was speaking completely out of turn, and they have absolutely not taken the possibility of a 2022 ballot initiative off the table. And Joe Salazar, the executive director for Colorado Rising, said his group is not backing down. He said he does not know what the governor means by a truce, and they are keeping everything on the table. Two candidates for the Colorado House of Representatives have filed a lawsuit Friday against Governor Polis and local officials over face mask mandates to fight the spread of COVID-19. The Daily Camera reports that the two candidates claim the mask orders compel political speech in violation of the U.S. Constitution. The plaintiffs, Mark Milliman and Donna Walter, are also suing Boulder County Public Health Executive Director Jeff Zayek, Larimer County Public Health Director Tom Gonzalez, and Fort Collins Manager Darren Atterbury. Milliman, a Republican, is running to unseat Democrat Karen McCormick in House District 11, while Walter, also a Republican, is running against Democrat Kathy Kipp in House District 52. It will be mostly sunny today with highs in the mid-80s and a small chance of thunderstorms after 2 p.m. Tomorrow there's a chance of showers in the morning that increases in the afternoon with highs again in the mid-80s. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is just coming up on 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, on Friday night, a terrible tragedy befell a Boulder County family that's also an integral part of the local farm and restaurant community. KGNU's Rosanna Longo has more.
My name is Andy Young. I'm the livestock manager for Black Cat Farms here in Boulder, Colorado. And we're a 425-acre certified organic, certified biodynamic farm-to-table outfit. We raise rare heritage animals and heritage organic vegetables. We're a lambing operation, so we breed all of our critters every year. We raise and breed all of our pigs every year and then finish everybody on pasture. I love working with the critters as a livestock manager. The livestock are the only nutrient source for our vegetable production. We often grow about 350 varieties of certified organic, certified biodynamic vegetables. And the only source of nutrients is rotating those animals through the pastures and letting that cycle of letting them eat the leftovers and defecating in there, and then we composting it into the soil, building like really healthy soils. And then we start things in greenhouses, and as soon as it's early enough, we transplant them outside, and then we pray over them and love them and water them and talk to all our plants. And so every day we're harvesting new vegetables out of the field. It changes literally on a daily basis. Those vegetables are washed and packed on our farm, and then they get distributed to our farm stand at 4975 J Road. That's 7 days a week from 10 to 5 p.m. You can buy ground lamb, ground pork, all our pork and lamb cuts, all our vegetables. That's also a location that our CSA members are able to pick up their produce from. And then we also do baked breads and then carry a lot of our friend farms that are also local farms in Boulder. We have Ella's produce and jams and jellies and dried fruits. We're also going to start carrying Ella's peaches and all the different beautiful bounty of fruits that grow out of Palisade in this winter, summertime. And then we carry Silver Canyon coffee and Boulder chips tortillas and a lot of different partnerships we have with other organizations. And then we do farm dinners 7 days a week at the owner's house. This is also the location last night of a tragedy that our farm experienced. The owners, Eric and Jill Skokan, their son of 19, was killed last night tragically on the farm when a head-on collision with a dump truck also collided into their home, and two of their sons were in the accident. Kelsey passed away immediately, and their other son, Ian, was taken to the hospital. As like difficult and tragic that this moment is and that it happened in the center of our farm, I think right in the center of our hearts, in order that the farm doesn't stop and that we don't go under, we're going to have to continue. Our farm stand's going to stay open. We're going to be at the Boulder County Farmers Market every single Saturday. We're hoping to join the market now on Wednesdays. We've canceled our farm dinner tonight just out of respect for Eric and Jill and the family, and The staff, though, knows that this is the heartbeat of the farm right now, and it's what's allowing us to, like, make payroll and to keep our employees, you know, living and eating. So tomorrow we start our farm dinners back up. We're going to have links on our website, blackcatboulder.com, where you can sign up for farm dinners. Since those sell out, though, and we don't have enough room for everyone, we're also going to start doing to-go baskets, like picnic baskets to go. You can select almost anything to go in that, including wine and beverages, and just pick it up and go. That's another thing you can find out on our website. And then we're also, through our daily newsletter, which you can sign up for at blackcatboulder.com, under the Connect with Us, we send out a letter every day telling you what we're harvesting. We're going to announce tomorrow what happened with Kelsey and our family. And we're also going to list tomorrow in our newsletter how you can reach out, how you can connect, how you can be in the GoFundMe, how you can buy farm dinner tickets, how you can contribute and participate with us through this tragedy and help us to connect and mourn and to be a part of this community and really rally around Eric and Jill and Black Cat.
And that's Angie Young, who is the livestock manager at Black Cat Farms. And as we heard there on Friday, the owners of the farm, Eric and Jill Skokan, lost their 19-year-old son, Kelsey, in a tragic accident at the farmhouse in Longmont that happened on Friday night. Well, we'll put more information about what's happening at Black Cat Farms and how the local community are rallying, including a GoFundMe account that's been set up to help the family. That'll be on our website, news.kgnu.org, later today. Now, this Thursday morning, just after 8:30, in the July installment of our monthly series Trends, a collaboration between KGNU and the Community Foundation of Boulder County, KGNU's Rosanna Longo will be taking a deep dive into local agriculture. As a community that says it wants to support local agriculture, how are we actually doing when it comes to supporting it? And certainly the COVID-19 pandemic has shone a spotlight on some of the vulnerabilities in our food system and highlights the importance of local food. So we'll hear more from Black Cat Farm on Thursday morning, as well as from some other local farms. That's as part of our Trends report. It's also a podcast, and if you haven't listened to it yet, we do encourage you to subscribe to that podcast. Search for KGNU wherever you get your podcasts, and particularly as we are honouring the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act, we encourage you to check out the podcast that takes a look at how we're supporting the local community, folks with disabilities. That's one of our recent Trends reports, so you can search for KGNU wherever you get your podcasts. It is 17 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, the Museum of Boulder is preparing for a community exhibit on Boulder's Latinx history and culture, and it's planning on opening in the fall of 2021. But right now, they're inviting the community to help curate and participate in the exhibit. Rosanna Longo has more.
Voces Vivas, Stories from the Latinx Community in Boulder, is a new project from the Museum of Boulder. Starting July 20th, the museum is preparing for a community exhibit on Boulder's Latinx history and culture. Juan García Oyervides spoke about the new project.
It seeks to include the voices of Latinx, Latino, Hispanic communities in the city and county of Boulder. And we are looking to create community partnerships with interested people and members of these communities who would like to collaborate with us. We think this is a very important project because we are trying to provide the physical space in the virtual space now for members of these communities to take ownership of the means through which they are represented, and particularly through the means which their history is represented and included into what is the city and the county of Boulder.
What are you trying to achieve with this display here?
Bring to the forum the attention on the different struggles that the Latinx and Hispanic communities are facing. This is somewhat of a historical debt, right? Because there's a lot of evidence on this that as an underrepresented community, as an underserved community, our stories are, for the most part, not included into the, let's call it, mainstream history, right? Mainstream narratives about the history of the United States, but also, in more particularly, of the county and city of Boulder. right? It is very important for the community at large as well to understand that when we talk about the Latinx, Hispanic, Chicano communities in anywhere really in the U.S., these are very diverse communities within themselves. So when we use these terms, you know, these broad umbrella terms, somehow we erase the differences and the richness that is embedded in these communities. And I think it is very important for those communities themselves, for our communities themselves, to portray those nuances, those differences. And I think this is a concentrated effort to try to provide those opportunities for self-representation.
Why is the museum, the Boulder Museum, wanting to bring that to the attention of the wider community?
I do perceive that the museum has a commitment that they are trying to uphold. And this is also part of, I think, a very healthy institutional self-reflection on how the practice of museum practices, right, have historically and practically been catering to white communities almost exclusively. And so I think this is an effort to try to work through that historical debt, and in particularly in the county of Boulder, I think that the community itself, the community, the wider community in Boulder is asking for our institutions, our local institutions, to do that self-reflection, and based on that self-reflection to act upon it, right? So to provide the means and the put the work to make sure that this is not only about words, and that we are actually doing the work that we need to do to correct these historical debts.
Can you explain to me what the project is going
to
be?
What it means to have a community curated exhibition is not that, you know, the museum is going to be collecting the stories of people and then folding them together into this broad Latinx label and, you know, like saying this is the Latinx history. Rather, a very different approach where we need not only their input, not only their stories, but also a willingness to get involved in how they see themselves fitting or not fitting into the Boulder County culture is the project itself. So what we are trying to do is not, again, not only collect the stories, but also to represent this process of this curational process as something that involves the community. Believe it or not, this is pretty much groundbreaking. Museum practices and museum studies have reflected about this for some time, I believe, where we ask ourselves as scholars, or the museums ask themselves as institutions, whether or not they are appropriating other people's experiences by putting them on display, right? Because that is what a museum is. It's a space for display of experiences of other people. So in regards to that, in trying to account for that practice, this is what the community curation project means. In that sense, the outcome is very different from a normal exhibition where, you know, we put together a set of artifacts and we just display them over time, right? This process, this program, or this project rather, starts with the curation process itself. And the curation process begins with the outreach. So this is why we are here, right? We would like to invite people to know that this is happening. We would like to let people know that it is important, it is essential that they get involved. And we're here to let the people know that we have experts who are there to support them. Because, you know, as a community member, I may have a lot to say, but then I may also feel a little bit shy how to share, whether or not this is going to impact my ability to maintain my either anonymity or my personal privacy. We have ways in which we can address those issues, any other concerns for that matter that community members may have. So that's why this call is so important.
Is it going to be a multimedia display?
Yes, that's a great question. So far, we have started to advertise a little bit this event or this series of events, right? So it is a multimedia project, right? So there are different ways in which people can get involved. So far, we have different ways in which the people, the community members can get involved. So one of the ways in which we are hoping to collect the input or the participation of the people is through what we're calling the at-home history kits. And these are kits that will allow them to learn how to preserve and to actually preserve certain artifacts, certain objects that they already have in their houses. These could be pictures that people have in their homes, pictures of families, or maybe some people that have been featured maybe in the newspapers, right? If they have the clippings of those recognitions, why not? Maybe some diplomas, right? Whatever it is, whatever objects that they have in their homes that has some sort of affective meaning, emotional meaning, and that, you know, talks about their identities as members of this community and as members of the Boulder community. This could be anything, right? So that's why we start with those. Another way in which people can share their stories is through the museum open hours, right? These open hours start on July 22nd and they run through September. You do not have to make an appointment for this. We're going to have staff available from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And so everybody's welcome to come. Everybody's welcome to drop by and either share their stories in whatever way they see fit. People can also make virtual appointments. The website is www.museumofboulder.org/voces. That's a voice in Spanish, right? V-O-C-E-S. You can find more information about the project in there.
That was Juan Garcia Oyervides talking about Voces Vivas, Stories from the Latinx Community in Boulder, a new project from the Museum of Boulder. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
And you can go by the Museum of Boulder to pick up a free kit to help preserve your family's history. Now, kits include materials that will protect family heirlooms, as well as ideas on how to start conversations with family and friends and parents about our own histories. You can do that every Wednesday, and every Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. through September, the museum will host a series of events where you can share your family and personal stories about living or working in Boulder County and hear other stories. It is 8:25. You're listening to KGNU. Well, earlier this month, a new report was released taking a look at the state of children's health and its relationship to the environment. The researchers looked at health and environmental data in a handful of states, including Colorado. I spoke with Ensay Witherspoon, who is the executive director of the Children's Environmental Health Network, one of the organizations involved in the report.
In a nutshell, looking at Colorado, for example, we know that poverty is an important social determinant of health. So, you know, every state in the country is dealing with poverty and poverty at the childhood level, sadly. 3.1 million children, roughly, is what we're looking at in the state of Colorado. So just as a baseline, that already is going to give an indication of how certain lower income children are already faring when it comes to overall health and wellness. We already know that's a glare of concern right there. The profiles are meant to be, again, engagement tools overall, but we can't avoid the elephant in the room, which is poverty. Poverty is a big driver for all of these issues we're talking about. Looking at, for example, water contamination. So water contamination plagues low-income areas and specifically communities of color, in particular across the country. But Colorado, is not averse to that. And about 40% of the public utilities we found had water violations just last year, 2019, compared to about 32% across the nation. Now, the 32% across the nation is still high to me, but the fact that a state is already above the national level in that indicator should be a red flag of concern. Also, 71% of Colorado children live in counties with unhealthy ozone pollution. And this comes from the American Lung Association State of the Air report that they put out every year, a very well-versed, well-respected, well-cited report gets down to county level air pollution data. So that's huge for us in the public health advocacy field for children, because we can really get serious about not only the state, but even at a county level where sources of air contaminants are really impacting certain children. And also, you know, I want to applaud something very positive that's happening. We try to really uplift positive aspects as well. The Denver Water's lead reduction program is actually working to replace all of their lead service lines in the next 15 years or so. That's 64,000 to 84,000 lead service lines. I think all of us know well the Flint water crisis, Newark lead water crisis, Washington, D.C. I mean, every city that has lead service lines in this country is going to have a quote unquote lead crisis if these lead service lines are not replaced. Lead can be exposed through certainly old paint in buildings and housing, and that is still a big part of that. But as we have come to find out, lead and other contaminants certainly can be passed along through continuous exposure to drinking water. So one thing we need to be serious about is replacing all lead service lines in every city that has them. that comes at a serious cost, right? It's like having a car and never maintaining it. And if you don't, it will have serious repercussions to your pocketbook, as well as maybe even having to get rid of that car down the road. So these are the things that I think, sadly, we've recognized that we have not collectively across the country really focused in on those lead service lines. And now they're contaminating, they decay, and they start contaminating the soil. So the piping. So those are just a couple highlights of where Colorado is. Now, I'll also add, Colorado, I think, is doing fairly decent in some other regards, and that should be noted. Like, you know, Denver's, you know, efforts on lead. And when you look at blood lead levels for the state of Colorado compared to the nation, it's around the same, if not a little bit less. Again, we need to do better across the country, right? So we don't want to just believe the national levels are the status quo. But I think, you know, as far as comparing yourself to other parts of the country and how you're doing in these indicators, that's a relatively better sign than some other states we've done that are well above the national average in some of these indicators. So
that's Ense Witherspoon, who is the executive director of the Children's Environmental Health Network, telling us that Colorado has a bit of a mixed bag when it comes to the state of children's health. This is according to a new report that they have released earlier this month. Colorado was one of several states that the organization looked at health and environmental data to compile their report.